It represents the nearest approach to an earthly heaven that it is possible to produce in material form. Yet, as you shall see, even these lovely people had to pay the price of their service, in that they too came to choose self instead of God until in the end they perished in the most degrading infamy the world has ever known. Ayo, by this time I was quite accustomed to the sudden changes in dimension essential to timeless exploration. Accustomed as I was to wondrous visions on opening my eyes, I was quite unprepared for the scene that I surveyed, my first glimpse of the lovely land of Atlantis. In previous experiences I had encountered that difficulty of focus that I have mentioned. But here, in this lovely landscape, I found a clarity of vision that amazed me. In this gloriously warm sunshine and freshness was surely the land of our dreams, indeed a golden environment. Wide spaces and fertile plains showed how everything had crystallized into a new and sun-washed definition. We were standing on the slopes of a hill looking out over a plain, which was watered by several rivers. I felt a thrill as I located a number of small villages here and there amid patches of cultivation. I longed to set out and investigate, but something held me to this hillside, savoring the warm scented beauty spread out before us. I felt so good that I told Zeros that I could have here the strength of two men. He smiled at my enthusiasm. Ayo, I'm glad you sense the inherent beauty of this land, which God had prepared for his children to live in and learn to know of his love for them. But alas, a broken bar, however, we will not spoil this first glimpse. Come, let us travel and see more of it. A with my hand held firmly in his, we traveled at our accustomed swift pace over the intervening country until we came to the first of the villages. This was composed of wattle huts of quite a large size, very cleverly made. When I saw my first Atlantean, I knew why. He must have been 7 or 8 feet tall, dark in skin, for he was one of the tribesmen who tilled the land. His skull was low and sloping with a broad projecting chin, and he wore a longish beard and hair. His clothing consisted of a loincloth. He walked erect and with an air of confidence that contrasted well with the uncertain movements of his ancestors. He entered a hut, and so we turned to where some children were playing, in the way that children of all ages have played. They at least, I mused, have not changed much. Then we perceived a little group approaching along a track. First came a man, like the other, of considerable stature, leading an animal harnessed to a sledge. It was something like a llama but larger and coarser. The use of the sledge showed that these people had not yet learned the use of the wheel. Seated on the sledge were two women in bright clothes, surrounded by a number of bundles. The women were dark-skinned like the men but with smaller features and bright, eager eyes. One was wearing earrings that might have been of gold, the other held a babe at her breast. Other children played about the sledge, dropping behind and then running to catch up. It was a pleasant domestic scene. Once the man turned his head sharply as if he heard some untoward sound from the adjacent forest and peremptorily called the children to him. Evidently, I thought, this smiling land is not without its stings. The abounding forests must harbor dangerous beasts, while no doubt there were poisonous reptiles among the luxuriant vegetation. Gorgeous plumaged birds there were in plenty, while once or twice we heard deep snarling sounds from the depths of the forest, but we did not see any beasts. As we moved on swiftly over hill and dale, the forest land gradually gave way to open grassland, with frequent patches of cultivation. Then presently, with a thrill, I caught the glint of sunshine, sparkling with reflected glory from some buildings on the horizon. These I soon found came from the domes and minarets of a city, and Zeros intimated that here was indeed none other than the famous city of the Golden Gates, that dreamlike city that has graced a thousand tales and legends. This prehistoric city, enshrined in the mists of antiquity, has lived so long in our unconscious memory that it still influences our dreams of a golden age when men knew not war and lived in harmony with their surroundings. Poets wrote of it and singers clothed it with a desperate longing, an age when love ruled. It still dwells in the background of our ideals, coloring our pageantry, the patina of our castles in the air, our dreams of utopia. I looked eagerly for the three legendary peaks. Yes, there they were. Behind the city, the Sentu one crowned with a temple that seemed to be of solid gold. Its domes were covered with gold leaf shining with an unmistakable reddish tint that betokens the precious metal. The walls were of a pinkish stone that served to enhance the glory of the glittering roofs. Down from the center hill cascaded clear waters from some hidden spring at the summit and, as I afterwards discovered, these served to feed a system of canals that provided traffic routes for the city. We stopped on the lower slopes of this hill and I saw that the city was divided into districts by these canals which encircled it three times before being drawn off by a channel to the sea. In the center were the larger buildings, probably minor temples and offices of importance, while in the next area were residential quarters. Beyond the second circuit of the canal system were obviously business houses, for here were many barges of rough timber tied up to wharves. Beyond again were small huts or shacks in which no doubt the tribesmen who served the city, lived with their families. After a while we descended into the city, entering it by one of the immense golden gates of legendary fame. Only at this period they were only gateways, the need for the protection of gates had not yet arisen. As we passed through the gateway we were faced with a magnificent vista of a broad avenue that indicated a high degree of civic planning. This then was the great capital of Atlantis, that in some form or another was to last many thousands of years, with a long and checkered history. As we traversed the city I saw no signs of mean side streets or dark alleys that hover behind the fair avenues of our modern cities. Though there was wide contrast of palace and humble dwelling it was clear that there was no intolerable division of rich consequence and utter degradation with which we are so hauntingly familiar. It was high noon when we entered the avenue and probably the hour of siesta for there were few people about. But some were obviously of the Adamic race. These were fine in the extreme, in strong contrast to the tribesmen, their clear white skin unmarked by strain or labor. Their eyes were blue and of a piercing keenness as if to indicate the intelligence and strange powers of their owners. Most were dressed in gay colors and draped robes. Naturally we had no means of intercourse with any of these people nor they any knowledge of our presence. We were separated by an immense dimension of time. In expansive mood, as if he were enjoying a return to a scene he had once known, Zeros seated himself on a stone bench beside the road in the shade of a large tree, and I joined him. At our feet strutted pigeons, for all the world as if they had alighted the from Trafalgar Square. AOUC. Eh, he said, gazing unseeingly at the pigeons. This descending race had to leave behind much of the glory of their real being when they descended from the Garden Beautiful. What you see of them here gives no idea of their erstwhile beauty or culture. And you must not blame either of the two races for the fall of this wonderful civilization. It had to be, for the good of mankind as a whole. It was a difficult situation, and fraught with danger as the lower race began to evolve. How did they worship at this time? I asked. The sun was always the focus of worship on Atlantis. Through the visible glory of the sun the people, especially the tribesmen, were able to visualize the supernal glory of that which they could not see. They could feel the warmth of spirit through the rays that vitalized their bodies, for here, you understand, the atmosphere was not yet vitiated by evil emanation as it became in later times. The Adamic people gave to the fallen race the message of love that was inherent in them from their own Eden. They taught of the love and beauty that they knew, of their unity of being and of the father-mother god whom they revered. And they demonstrated their psychic powers with an adept manipulation which the tribesmen regarded as magic. On the other hand, the tribesmen had something to offer the superior race. They had experience of good and evil, right and wrong, bought dearly through close contact, an experience of some value to beings who had known only the good, with no contrast to show the difference. Our conversation was broken by a disturbance further down the street. There was some singing and shouting in the distance, and as the sounds drew nearer I could see that a crowd of people was advancing, mostly of the darker race. At their head strode a figure, striking in appearance, a head taller than most. He was dressed in a robe of azure blue edged with silver, while on his head he wore a fillet of gold fronted with some emblem I could not distinguish at that distance, and on his breast there was a large gem that sparkled as he walked. He radiated vitality that I could feel even where I stood, and he seemed the very embodiment of spiritual strength and grace. Zeros, too, stood in respect, and as the stranger passed threw out his arms in glad salutation, and immediately the visitor turned his head and a lovely smile of recognition lit up his features, his eyes shining with love and joy. It was a thrilling moment, for such was the understanding between these two that they had been able to bridge the gap of thousands of years that divided them, destroying the illusion of time in one blinding moment of truth. Even I got caught up in that shattering moment, for the royal figure glanced at me and his keen gaze searched my very soul. Then he smiled at me too, and his eyes filled with an eloquence I can scarcely describe. Can man love man? If so, then I loved this man. This stranger who was strangely known to me, a part of my life, geared with me to the wheel of events. Before I could recover my sense of time he was gone, with the crowd of jostling, admiring followers in his wake. With all my heart I longed to join them. The voice of Zeros broke in. Ao, that was one of the great leaders and teachers of Atlantean times, Ao, he observed. Ao, I cannot give you his name in eternity, and his name in time has been lost to posterity, though it was perpetuated in the later pantheon of so-called gods, those travesties of the Shining Ones who were held to have disported themselves with human antics on Mount Olympus. But as you have seen, they were beings of very real beauty and power, never wholly incarnate, yet living amongst the people they had come to aid. Ai begged for further information about the kings of Atlantis, but Zeros had little to say about these. Ao, if I were to tell you of Melkarth, Hercules, twin rulers of Atlantis, whose deification was later commemorated by the twin pillars of bronze in the temples of Western Europe dedicated to them, you would try and trace their dynastic era, only to find disillusion. You cannot connect these great beings, more ethereal than physical, with your conception of kings and priesthood, any more than you can connect the Neptune, with his antics on crossing the line, with that great king of Atlantis who once ruled from the Golden Temple in this city of the Golden Gates. The realities were neither physical kings nor mythical deities, so you will have to be content with that. As he spoke, there was a sudden vibration beneath our feet. I looked up and felt, rather than heard, a distant rumble travel round the hills. Ao, thunder! Ai echoed. But an instant later the supposition was lost in a thunder and a roar the like of which I had never heard. A few people screamed, while the birds rose in perturbed flight, squawking their fears. Once more the ground heaved, thunderous noises smothering all others. Even Zeros looked momentarily alarmed. The earthquake passed as suddenly as it came. There seemed little trace of damage, no doubt because of the still plastic nature of the crust which enabled the shocks to be absorbed. Soon after, twilight descended, and to my surprise the city remained aglow. The light came from high pylons which I had noticed, at the top of which was a glowing light, which Zeros informed me was atomic in nature, generated by a process lost to us. Then he led the way into a compound in the center of which was a house, somewhat like a Roman villa in design. It was a two-storied residence, surrounded by verandas. In one of these a family sat at a meal. With some trepidation I drew nearer, until I remembered that our presence held no relation to the susceptibilities of these people. They were white Atlanteans, two women, a man and two children. The wooden bowls they used seemed rather clumsy to my notion, but otherwise it might have been a family party gathered in some colonial bungalow of our time. Dark-skinned servants waited and handed round the dishes, while the family sat on low stools and ate with their fingers. The dishes held what appeared to be curds and honey, while a great dish of fruit occupied the center of the table. One servant brought in a jug of sparkling liquid which he poured into wooden mugs. There appeared to be no distinction between employer and servant, no sign of servitude. It seemed that each race was conscious of the advantages of their mutual association. I would not, however, like to maintain that Atlantean society of this period differed little from our own contemporary society. For one thing, there was an air of unsophistication, a lack of assurance, that characterized these people, as if they found their environment difficult with no traditions to fall back upon. Life in the Garden Beautiful must have unrolled for them like the pattern on the nursery carpet does for our children, nothing to fear, only to enjoy. But now they had to build their own traditions without any deep experience to aid them in molding their lives. They had only their spiritual strength to fall back upon. It was a poignant thought that these lovely innocent people were destined to succumb to the evil, inherent but not yet manifest, in the very soil they trod. Zeros explained that the rhythmic ebb and flow of the spiritual power that manifests the universe brought them succeeding waves of spiritual strength, which ebbed away so that they might be led to depend upon its return flow. Such too is life in our day, when exaltation so often is followed by depression, though naturally to a less extent than these people experienced. Such was the condition of the two races which were meeting and merging in this lovely land. As the young men of the fair race grew in vigor, they were looked upon by the adoring daughters of the tribesmen, and many succumbed to the age-old urge of humankind, and so began that fatal admixture of the two races, the one divine and ethereal, the other so coarsened that intelligence was dimmed, that was to have such dire results for the greatest civilization this world has ever known. Perhaps it had to be, being part of the testing of the spirit of both races, part of a great plan of rehabilitation for the fallen race of man. Zeros and I paid many visits to this rare and wonderful city at varying stages in its history, which has been calculated to have lasted over 750,000 years, in one form or another. Its story is like that of a man, born in innocence, growing in stature and knowledge, faced with the temptation of self-indulgence and ambition, put to the test at every point in his progress, until at last he lays down his material body, his mission completed. Its gradual decline and the catastrophic ending of the whole continent was due to the emergence into manifestation of the latent evil created by the fallen race, so that it could be objectified and thus transmuted. As Zeros put it, "Ao God does not make mistakes, with him all things work together for good. If you break his laws, he immediately sets forces to work to rectify your mistakes. He does not interfere with your free will, for that is essential to your progress. Instead, he projects his divine love in such power that it bums out the dross in the offender and his environment. Thus there is suffering. A quite clearly the golden temple on the three-pronged hill behind the city was the dominating factor in its life, and almost certainly the source of its spiritual power. In the earliest, almost ethereal conditions in which it was created, so holy were the vibrations manifested that it was almost etheric in nature, and only initiates were allowed within its precincts. There was a wall of etheric powers surrounding it which only an adept could pass. But when Zeros and I first saw it, the actual temple was in the form of a cross surrounded by circular gardens, thus epitomizing the sign manual of the earth, the cross of sacrifice within the circle of redemption. The cross was formed by four great halls branching off from the central dome, so vast that St. Paul's Cathedral could easily be contained within it. As there were no corrosive elements in that clear atmosphere and matter was not so dense and cohesive as it is today, buildings of this description lasted for incredible periods of time. Exteriorly, the temple was exquisitely designed, with the central dome covered with gold of a redness unknown to our geologists, and with an array of slender spires that were covered with silver, seeming to stretch like fingers adoringly into the azure sky. The main approach was from the east, up cascading flights of steps, punctuated by level platforms on which were flanking statues and sculptured designs of mystic interpretation. Before the main entrance was a broad open hall of pillars, with a floor of wondrously designed mosaic, while fountains played unceasingly to add to the cool comfort of the shade after the heat of the sun-drenched exterior. Feeling like pygmies, we made our way into the interior. The high priests were, at this period, also the kings of the Atlantean Empire, so it had a temporal as well as a spiritual character. Zeros explained that the first Great Hall was the one devoted to governmental affairs. It was without windows, being lit by the same method as used on the pylons in the city. The walls were decorated with wonderful sculptured designs and mural paintings out of consonance with the poor artistic ability displayed in other parts of the city. Passing through this hall into the center nave, I gasped in amazement, for under the great dome, whose loftiness extended almost beyond my vision, was a colossal statue of the deity whom we know as Poseidon, fashioned, heaven alone knows how, in solid gold. The figure was driving a chariot drawn by 6 horses over a sea of golden foam. How can I do justice to such a stupendous creation? I could not even conjecture how it came to be erected, nor the astronomical value of the metal. But it was so exquisitely fashioned that life and vitality seemed to radiate from it. The leaping horses, the boat-like chariot, the curling waves, but most of all the virility derived from that powerful figure, all seemed to melt into a message of power. I could well imagine that it formed a transforming station for divine power, slowed down to meet the lower vibrations of this mundane kingdom. Regretfully, we passed on to the further hall, only to experience the same sense of wonder. For here there was no decoration at all except for a golden sunburst in the roof. Below it was a low stone altar. The light was dimmed here and helped to create an atmosphere which met you at the entrance and enfolded you with a mysterious sense of something exquisitely beautiful and holy, not to be embodied in form. I felt nearer to God in this holy sanctuary than anywhere I have ever known. One felt holy here, touched by that divine stillness that is such a benediction to the soul. One could almost hear the words, "Ao come unto me." The loveliness of that moment was such that I could not estimate how long we stood there, in adoration of that which was within. But we could not stand the forever, and presently Zeros drew me to a side hall which was broken up into sanctuaries, libraries and living quarters. In the libraries were books, not very many, with pages of paper-thin metal, bound in leather. The writing was in ideographs, complicated in character. The hall on the opposite side was much the same but included what appeared to be public offices. In one part of the temple we found a garden of gold, such as Montezuma displayed to Cortes. Exquisitely formed flowers of gold, with insects and tiny birds of the same metal, flutteringly poised upon golden twigs, were set in gold dust soil. The golden effulgence and richness of the effect was beyond description. On another occasion we were privileged to attend one of the civic ceremonies in the great entrance hall. This was at a later period and there were some small changes to be noted. Now a gay crowd of chattering townsfolk was thronging the approaches or sauntering in the quiet gloom of the pillared hall. Temple servants in liveries of black with the insignia of the temple, a red cross worn on a white circle on the breast, marshaled the people into the great hall. All was done in order and dignity, for these burghers seemed to take their duties seriously. There was music of a sort to enliven the proceedings, but it was somewhat crude in character, being limited to a few conch horns, drums, cymbals and simple stringed instruments. Presently the conch horns sounded a fanfare and an air of expectancy stilled the assembly. A procession of priests and notables entered the hall from the central nave, wonderfully garbed in azure blue edged with silver, with the same insignia on their breasts, except that in this case the cross was of gold. Some priests wore a headdress of gold with a shining gem set in it. In the center of the procession came the king priest, more gorgeously apparelled than all the rest. Atlantis was still in a state of enlightenment and I could see that this was a great soul, sent on a divine mission. I will not attempt to describe the ceremonial for it was beyond my interpretation. There were presentations of petitions, delivery of decisions by the king, the promulgation of announcements and a number of speeches. Zeros reminded me that this was a theocracy, in which the king priest was held to be a channel of divine guidance, God ruling direct through man. A fact true in those days, though only its shadow has followed monarchy into modern times. At length justice was done, in seal of which the king drank ceremoniously from a goblet of chased silver, clustered with precious stones. Then the court withdrew to another fanfare and the crowd flowed out into the sunshine again, eagerly discussing what had transpired. It seemed to me that religion among these people of mixed race was general rather than particular. Worship of one god, usually through the medium of the sun or through temple ritual, seemed to form the background of their lives rather than a thing apart, as in later civilizations. Away from the capital, religion was a different matter. In the provinces, the Adamic influence was not so great, and with poor communications, the white missionaries had difficulty in impressing the tribesmen in the more distant and sparsely populated regions, so that secret inhibitions held the people captive and prevented their spiritual development. Though they outwardly accepted the teachings and were absorbed in the psychic demonstrations they witnessed, they were hardly moved by them. It was in the soul that development was slow, for its awareness could only be cautiously awakened because of the occult knowledge that was latent there and which would undoubtedly be misused. So it was not easy to impress the villagers who would not leave their own villages. For them, natural manifestations of seismic or volcanic origin had far more powerful demanded propitiation of an exacting nature. Such was the profound difference between the two races at these early stages in the history of the continent. Yet the white race strove hard to fulfill their mission, and they accomplished much by force of example. The tribesmen would nod and chatter when they witnessed psychic demonstrations at the temples, but they would rather possess a reputed chip off one of the sacred statues in the golden temple than touch the hem of a white teacher's garment. In time, many of the dark-skinned people became educated and demanded entry to the priesthood, and thus became adepts in the use of the mysterious psychic powers. It was inevitable that their sorry inheritance must overshadow their natural desires, and soon the malignant influence of the dark forces in the lower astral realms sought to use this opportunity to extend smudging fingers of evil into this lovely land, until a growing number of junior priests had come under the subtle control of a force that was difficult to identify and which could not be stayed. If one surveys the tragic history of man right down to the present day, it is clear that the Atlantean civilization could not be expected to succeed. The cleansing of the fallen race was far too weighty a matter to be settled by the sweetening of one organ stable. Divine prescience must have realized that many civilizations must rise and fall before this Herculean task could be accomplished. Yet because spirit is omnipotent and evil has no existence outside the free will of man, the end was certain and the experience imprisoned within the thraldom of time. The white Atlanteans were endowed with a genius for colonization. Quite early in their history, steady streams of colonists went forth to far quarters of the globe, carrying to the indigenous inhabitants tales of these golden isles of the blessed, which survive in so many local legends in widely separated areas. Nearly all these stories have a common basis, of the arrival of large canoes or rafts, from which stepped white-skinned bearded men, wearing black robes with the insignia of the cross upon the circle. Always were they credited with psychic powers, and they spoke of a sun god who dwelt in a golden land, far beyond the spreading ocean. Meanwhile, the degeneration in the main continent increased as the centuries grew into millennia. Born of the two races, a new people came into being, proud, fearless, accomplished in the arts of war. Perversion began in the many sects that split theocracy into controversial elements. No longer were spirit teachers able to manifest in the temples, though a residue of their psychic powers remained and was used by the priests to extend their power over the people. In appearance, the new race, which I saw in later visits with Zeros, was not unlike the North American Indian, but with a more sloping forehead. But of course there were many strains in this biracial people, including the Negroid type. New gods were worshipped, and these talked to them of power, of conquest, and of all the things that make a man's heart swell with pride. And hints were thrown out of matters that could not be spoken of openly, but which were done in the dark recesses of the forest, bringing a maddening excitement all their own. The eyes of men glinted as they talked of mysterious doings in caves, the first hint of a soul-destroying sadism that was to eat away the heart of man. The blight was beginning to fall upon this splendid land and only needed receptive minds to make its slow eroding conquest. Thus began yet another fall of man, one that could not be prevented if man, as one whole conception of the Creator, was to purge itself of the incubus of sin and stand erect once more. Chapter 10, The Great Catastrophe. There are many stories extant concerning the end of the Atlantean civilization, but few of these record the truth, that the subsidence which marked its end had really been going on for thousands of years.